These people learned how to control others through the use of a hidden knowledge. This ability to keep that fire going was a technology that nobody else knew. By observing the fire, by keeping it going, by creating ceremonies around this fire, they became a mystery to the others. A mystery always holds sway over those who don't understand it. And the priesthood was born. No king ever existed without the permission of the priesthood. Now, I don't care what religion you're talking about or what period of history you're talking about, it is the truth. The kings never had the power and don't to this day. Kings exist at the whim of the real power, which is the priesthood standing behind the throne. And when the king ceased to be of benefit to the priesthood, they would simply poison him or get rid of him in some other way. The king is dead, long live the king, and there would be another king appointed.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Labour Party Oxford economist Martin Summers and former Sunday Times Rich List journalist Kevin Carhill. Me, Tony Gosling. More on possible Israeli connections to the Christchurch massacre. One of New Zealand's biggest mosques, the chairman says Mossad was behind Christchurch massacre, but does he have any evidence? And is this lone wolf myth? Is it the same sort of situation as we had with Breivik, who turned out to have all sorts of interesting links? Killer 2011 in Norway. Also, how easy is it for the super wealthy, the Queen or Jacob Rothschild, to hide their wealth? Why is the Queen falling down, languishing somewhere at the bottom of the Sunday Times Rich List? Should she really be there? Plus, Christian Zionists hate pastors in the US. We heard a bit last week. Pretty shocking stuff. But what are they saying to encourage the killing of Muslims? And words of encouragement for Israeli politicians. From the Israeli Security Cabinet, we also hear tonight from Moshe Kalon, the secretive finance minister. What does he have to say about the Israeli state's biblical history and rights? Apparently, he's an expert. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM Tuesday at noon. This week, part two of Brig Ubridge's commentary, taking us through his personal history of Stonehenge, Glastonbury, the UK Travellers, peace convoys and free festivals. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download it from dialectradio.co.uk now. Well, we're joined by Martin Summers. Martin, you sent me something during the week about, this is about the chairman of the New Zealand's biggest mosque saying Mossad was behind the Christchurch massacre that left 50 people dead. But the question is there actually any evidence, or is this actually anti-Semitism from the leader of the New Zealand Muslims?
Well, the Daily Mail have probably reproduced this because that's what they want to imply. I think he can't possibly have any solid evidence at this stage, but the idea that they might be behind it is perfectly rational given what we know of their previous behaviour and what we know about false flag terrorism run by Western-oriented intelligence services, including Mossad.
The other really shocking thing that's come out this week, really, it was the first time I saw it was on Sky, was that the killer, with his, you know, killed 50 people over there, it had a lot of similarities with the Breivik killing, didn't it? The idea that a sort of peripheral, trusted, peaceful country can come under this sort of horrible attack. And it turns out that this guy was in touch with Breivik online. I mean, how is it that someone like Breivik is allowed to get on the internet and I suppose you might say radicalise, but to encourage this kind of hate, horrible idea of killing loads of innocent people.
Well, I think the more important question is not whether they got radicalised on the internet, but who they actually physically met. And of course, this guy, if he is who they say he is, has been to lots of very interesting places, including Turkey and Israel. And the Turks have already picked up on this, saying, well, he's been here twice. And of course, you know that the Western Intelligence Service has been moving lots of people in and out of Turkey to keep up the pressure on Assad in Syria. And they've been basically supporting terrorist activities in Syria for years and years and years. So why wouldn't they do something similar in New Zealand? If, I'm not saying they did, I think to say that we know what happened here before there's been a trial and all the rest of it is previous. But we've got to actually bear in mind that there's a lot of hostility by the Israelis towards the New Zealanders because their agents have been caught out there trying to steal people's identities in Christchurch after the earthquake, as we said last week, and previously people who were disabled who were unlikely to travel. So there's a lot of hostility there, which, and of course what this does is it creates, as the strategies of tension did in the 70s and the 80s, it creates a call...
In Italy
and elsewhere. I mean, it wasn't just in Turkey. There was a massive strategy of tension, for example, which, and all the bombings and the shootings that were supposedly being carried out by radicalised groups and left and right suddenly stopped when the military seizes power in 1980. And that was all part of NATO's strategies. So, in other words, New Zealand and Norway as kind of progressive small countries on the periphery thought that they were going to escape from all of this, but of course they have to be drawn in, they have to be dragged in, they have to be made to feel that they are part of this general crisis so that those who are behind these things can get the results they want. We shouldn't jump to any conclusions about anything, but we certainly shouldn't presume that we're being told the whole truth about what went on, because we're not.
This milieu is actually the same kind of thing which was done by Tommy Robinson, isn't it, and the EDL, the founders of the EDL. A lot of these people saw themselves as Knights Templar doing some sort of holy crusade against Islam.
Well, my take on all of this is the radicalised jihadi groups of Wahhabi orientation run by the Saudis and the extreme right-wing anti-Muslim crusaders, if you like, that milieu, they're heavily, heavily infiltrated by Western and Israeli intelligence services, often the same thing. And that they are running a globalised strategy of tension, not just a single country, like Italy, but a global strategy.
We know a
to create problems so that which can then be resolved by those who think they've got the answers.
We know a chap called Torstein Vidal, who's been on this programme a few times, and at the time of the Breivik massacre in Norway, 70 people he killed in a similar sort of fashion, just with an automatic rifle, just going around murdering people, in some sort of an attempt to... I mean, can you just talk about the background of who he was killing and why it's quite similar to this Christchurch massacre?
Well, what's very similar in both attacks is there were two sites of attack. So Breivik supposedly let off a bomb inside Oslo against a government building, which killed a number of people. Then he got in a car and drove all the way to Utøya and used an automatic weapon to kill loads of Labour Party young socialists who were on their summer camp. Now, in actual fact, you've got to question, is that physically possible? And, of course, what Torstein Vidal pointed out, which came out at the inquest, was after the bombs had gone off in Oslo, there should have been a national lockdown. That is national strategy and national policy in Norway. But that lockdown didn't take place. And he was able to identify the police woman who should have pressed the button which caused the lockdown and didn't do it. Now, the suspicion has to be that, like the assassination of Olof Palme in Sweden in the 1990s, pointed very firmly to NATO's Gladio networks, because Olof Palme had been basically a progressive politician undermining anti-Soviet and NATO-oriented policy. And basically, you're just not allowed to do that. And New Zealand, for example, didn't have any... you know, it's banned nuclear warships from its waters for 20, 30 years now. So it caused a great deal of gnashing of teeth.
Let's get back to Christchurch, because
we're just talking about
Off Guardian, this published a fascinating article, which I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It says, lone wolf myth covers up possible Mossad role in New Zealand terrorist attack. And they're not just speculating, they're explaining the links of the far right to Zionists and actually Nazi-supporting people. For example, Breivik was a supporter of the fascists in Nazi Germany, but he was also a Zionist. And Tommy Robinson has been being funded to, not totally, but certainly there's evidence that things like his court cases, his defence, etc., was funded from Zionist sources.
Yeah, well, you can see this kind of new alignment beginning to... It's not that new. It's been going on for years. For example, the Azov Battalion, neo-Nazi paramilitaries in Ukraine, are supplied directly by the Israeli government with Israeli weaponry, because they've got the same geopolitical goals. And the right is aligning behind the right wing in Israel. So, because, you know, they see the scapegoat enemy now to be Muslims. And of course this is causing some problems for the right wing, because in Poland, Netanyahu went there recently for this sort of anti-Iran meeting that had been organised by the Americans. And basically the Poles, the Israelis are saying that the Poles are naturally anti-Semitic, and the Poles are taking umbrage at that and saying, we're not naturally anti-Semitic, we don't like your attitude. So in actual fact there is still tension on the right about this. But Netanyahu had no problem going to Lithuania, where people in the government are a lot, you know, former neo-Nazis, and of course the support for the far right in Ukraine. Well, Kolomoisky is a Jewish oligarch, but he's a major patron of the Azov Battalion.
And he's also one of the sponsors of this comedian. It looks like next week he's going to win the Ukrainian elections.
Yeah, well, he's not going to win. He's going to come first.
Oh, okay.
But then there'll be a runoff, and it's quite likely he will win, which is actually a relatively positive sign, because he basically represents the feeling in Ukraine that they're sick of extreme nationalist rhetoric. They just want some
and
jobs.
So some sort of puppet TV personality.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in the circumstances, he wouldn't be a bad result. Don't forget that all of the pro-Russians in the Crimea and the Donbass have already seceded, so they can't vote in this anyway. So you're left with rump Ukraine, which is inevitably going to be more right-wing than Ukraine was when it was a United States.
We'll be talking more about that side of things later, but right now we're joined on the line, I hope, by Mark Watts. Are you there, Mark? Can you hear me?
I am. Hi. Hello.
So Mark Watts is an investigative journalist and very prolific on Twitter, and you've been covering absolutely brilliant... Well, I mean, I shouldn't say that, really, but you're very one of the only people to be doing thorough coverage of the National Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse. But it was originally called the VIP Defile Inquiry. I wonder, Mark, if you could just take us through... what about because the original idea was to investigate VIPs. How has the inquiry been doing on that side of things?
Well, that's not quite what it was. I mean, that's what provoked it in the first place when Theresa May, when she was Home Secretary in 2014, announced this overarching inquiry into child sexual abuse in the country. It transpired that it wasn't quite so, didn't turn out to be so overarching as, you know, the words implies. But what provoked it were allegations that various VIPs had been sexually abusing children and basically had not been properly prosecuted or investigated by the police stroke criminal justice system. That's what provoked it. Once the inquiry finally sort of got going, it announced 13 different investigations into a whole range of areas, one of which is become known as the Westminster investigation, which is, in a sense, an investigation into the issue that provoked the inquiry in the first place. And what's been happening on that is that we've just come to the end of 3 weeks of hearings, taking evidence, listening to witnesses, talking about that issue, essentially.
Do you think that they have left no stone unturned with this, there's now no VIP can use their establishment influence to stop investigation of their potential crimes in the past?
Well, there are plenty of stones that have been left well and truly where they were. Nonetheless, what has happened over the course of the last 3 weeks is there has been yet more evidence first of all, that some specific VIPs were indeed sexual abusers of children, that there was pretty definite evidence, definitive evidence in some cases, in a couple of cases, and I think it's going to be impossible for the inquiry not to acknowledge that. But perhaps more importantly, when it comes to institutional responses to that, is there was a failure either by the police or by the criminal justice system as a whole, prosecutors and so on, to take appropriate action. And again, I think it's going to be impossible not to conclude that that did happen. Now, quite how often that happens, is another matter, because, as I say, plenty of the stones have been left well and truly in place. But just to cite a couple of examples, you know, we heard how, in the case of, say, Victor Montague, who is the late Conservative MP, had been sexually abusing boys. We heard, in the course of 3 weeks, literally from only one abuse survivor testified, and that was Victor Montague's own son, Robert, who gave extremely moving testimony about some very frank testimony about what his father did to him and the failure to investigate that at the time. But it came as a bit of a shock to Robert to find out many years later that his father was investigated over allegations made by one specific other boy. I think from memory, he was a young boy, I think of about 10, who made allegations against his father. And in a nutshell, his father admitted to them, to the police, and yet the decision was made by the DPP's office at the time not to prosecute him and simply to caution him because he promised not to see that boy again. Now, Robert gave evidence to say that he is sure that his father sexually abused many other boys, at least 10, he thinks probably more like 20. But it's come as quite a shock to learn that police and prosecutors knew that his father was doing this because he admitted to it in the case of at least one boy, and yet he wasn't charged. Likewise, with Sir Peter Hayman, who is the former MI6 chief, he became deputy head of MI6, was a diplomat, worked for MI6 for many years under diplomatic cover, became envoy to UK's envoy to Canada, High Commissioner to Canada. It transpired that the police did quite a thorough job in investigating him specifically over a seizure of diaries which recorded, 45 volumes of diaries which recorded a mixture of sexual abuse of children that he had carried out, as well as sexual abuse of children about which he was fantasizing. It was a mixture of the two. But they were specifically sent a file to the DPP's office, as it then was, as before the CPS became into existence. And basically, his solicitor, Sir David Napley, had a friendly chat with the DPP of the day, a chummy chat, and they agreed not to charge him and just to caution him, just to warn him about his conduct. And it's pointed out in the course of evidence by the police officer who investigated that case that it was put to him, surely there were the guidelines at the time, so he shouldn't have been prosecuted. He wasn't making any money out of this. He said yes, but he was exchanging this obscene material through the post, which was what the subject of the possible charge was. He was exchanging this material with another guy who was prosecuted. The only difference was the other guy was a bus conductor. He wasn't some high-flying diplomat. And he didn't have Sir David Napley, who could have a friendly, chummy chat with the DPP, and he was prosecuted and convicted. Self-same material being exchanged, but the prominent person got off with it. So there was clear evidence that emerged in the course of the hearings that people have got away with it, who are occupying prominent positions. We've actually heard in other limbs of the inquiry about how there were missed opportunities to prosecute both Cyril Smith and Greville Janner. When I say we've heard in the course of the inquiry, I mean, I think we had heard that before the inquiry started, because there have been official admissions by the CPS that in each case there were three occasions when, as I say, in each case they should have been prosecuted but were not. So the evidence is mounting up of this kind of lenient treatment towards people in positions of public prominence.
But actually, Mark, sorry, but with Lord Janner, for example, several people have said that this accusations are malicious and have been done behind his back since his death.
Well, they haven't simply been made since his death, but certainly, the allegations were denied in Greville Janna's case by Greville Janna at the time, because of course he was alive when the latest investigation was ongoing. He denied the allegations completely, and his son Daniel has continued to deny them, as it were, on his behalf since Greville died. And it has to be said that the inquiry has not... Well, we haven't reached Janna yet, actually. Janna was not the subject of this investigation. We haven't got that far yet. And I don't expect the inquiry will reach a conclusion as to whether or not he was a sexual abuser of, in his case, boys. But what we already know is the CPS has put its hands up to the fact that there were three occasions over the years when he ought to have been prosecuted on the strength of the evidence that was available at the time. Now, it's not the same thing as saying he ought to have been convicted, because, of course, the CPS cannot say that. They can merely say whether or not he should have been prosecuted. And during the course of the hearings, we heard from the legal director of the CPS, Gregor McGill, who basically added two more people to that list of people who today would be prosecuted on the same evidence that they got away with in the past. Those two people, those two additional people being Victor Montague and Peter Hayman, Conservative MP and diplomat, respectively, added to the list that the CPS had already effectively given us of Cyril Smith, Liberal MP, and Greville Janna, Labour MP.
What about police whistleblowers and survivors, you could say, because some of them have had a terrible time when they've tried to tell the truth within the police?
Yes. Well, that's certainly true, and the inquiry heard none of that because they weren't interested in hearing from survivors. There was literally only seven survivors of Cyril Smith who were represented, who were core participants in the inquiry, although we didn't hear from them in this investigation. We've heard from them in the Rochdale investigation, so we have heard from them in a separate limb, and one other abuse survivor as a core participant, but the only abuse survivor to testify was, as I mentioned earlier, Robert Montague. What we have heard a lot from, though, so we've heard really from very few, or we've heard from one abuse survivor. There were abuse survivors who were frozen out of being core participants or witnesses. But what we've heard from a few police whistleblowers, not many, I have to say, plenty of whistleblowers, police whistleblowers were stopped from giving evidence or stopped from being core participants. But we did hear from memory, I think it was about five of them, and their evidence is really quite extraordinary. In essence, what we heard time and time again was that people, members of the establishment, members of what I think one officer talked about, the upper echelons of society, we knew were sexually abusing children over many, many years, and we were repeatedly failing to deal with them. And there was one, I mean, I just remember one line that came out from Brian Collins, who investigated Sir Peter Hayman, who just made this reference to, you know, best club in the world, Three Knights of the Realm, when Sir David Napley went and saw Sir Thomas Hetherington, the former being Sir Peter Hayman, solicitor, the latter being the DPP. So one knight sees the other knight to say, please let my client, this other knight, the third knight, off. And he duly did. And this is a kind of repeated pattern that we see. And although the authorities are trying to sort of say, you know, try and say there's not much to see here and even nothing to see here, there's an attempt to say, I think a senior commander from the Met said she did not recognise this kind of description of Scotland Yard or of policing, even in the day, let alone now. But the evidence, I think the evidence is overwhelming, that that is precisely what the culture was like, that there was a sense that they couldn't touch these prominent people.
You mentioned core participant status there. I noticed that the former Conservative MP, Harvey Proctor, who was prosecuted, he's now also become a core participant, and quite a lot of the survivors have raised objections to that, saying that they do not wish to participate in an inquiry where somebody like that is given that kind of status.
Well, first of all, of course, he was prosecuted and convicted of sexual offences back in the 80s, and they related to teenage boys/men who were underage as the age of consent existed then, although not under the age of consent as it would exist today. He was given core participant status at a very late stage in this inquiry, just shortly before the hearings commenced. I mean, the preliminary hearings to this investigation took place ages ago. The deadline for core participants to apply was ages ago. Now, it did rather imply that the inquiry was going to hear evidence about him. That would be the only reason why it would be appropriate to give him core participant status. And we always knew that the inquiry was not going to consider Operation Midland in any way, shape or form. They were cutting that out of scope. So it wasn't at all obvious why Harvey Proctor was relevant at all. So having had the 3 weeks of hearings, in fact, we've not heard a word of evidence either for or against Harvey Proctor. Absolutely nothing. It's a complete mystery as to why the inquiry decided to give him core participant status. But, of course, it's become a platform for him to make various points that he's wanted to make in his barrister's opening speech and, indeed, closing speech today, which basically amounts to saying, I am completely innocent. And, indeed, he wants the inquiry to declare him completely innocent, even though the inquiry, as I say, haven't actually heard any evidence either for him or against him.
So do you think it's fair for survivors of child sexual abuse to, you know, to seriously object to him being in that position and for them to say, some of them have said, that they don't want to participate anymore?
Well, I think it's fair enough in the circumstances as they've unfolded. I mean, when he was given it, no one could know, no survivors could know exactly what evidence might surface during the course of the inquiry. And if evidence had surfaced that was highly relevant to him, then he would actually have a right to be a core participant. It's just that no such evidence surfaced one way or another. So there's no proper basis for him being given that status. And it raises enormous questions about, you know, the inquiry and its real ability to grapple with this in a fair and even-handed way. If on the one hand you're excluding police whistleblowers as survivors from being core participants, on the one hand, but then on the other you're granting Harvey Proctor core participant status for no apparent reason, it doesn't look good, does it?
Also, Sir David Steele, this is one bit that did make a few headlines. So much of what's going on at this inquiry doesn't seem to get the traction in the national news that it should do. I mean, if you consider the power and importance of those people who are being discussed at that inquiry, Sir David Steele believed Cyril Smith, the child sexual abuse claims about Cyril Smith, but he didn't act. Is that how it's happened?
Well, that's right. I mean, first of all, he's Lord Steele now, I'll have you know, not merely a Sir David Steele. Lord Steele basically shredded his reputation when he went in the witness box. It was quite an astonishing day. He essentially, having dismissed, in television interviews, allegations about Cyril Smith as being tittle-tattle and that kind of thing, he went in the witness box and said, well, actually, I asked Cyril Smith, when allegations surfaced that emanated from this Rochdale Alternative Paper report, which in turn were repeated by Private Eye, I asked Cyril Smith about the version that appeared in Private Eye, and Cyril Smith told me, yeah, this is true. Suddenly, so it turns out Lord Steele was admitting to the fact that Cyril Smith had admitted to him that he was physically and sexually abusing boys in Cambridge House Hostel. I think I've got that name right. It was a boys' hostel up in Rochdale. Quite astonishing, given that Lord Steele has been trying to tell people that it was all tittle-tattle and so much nonsense. It's a real example of that knee-jerk way that members of the establishment like to dismiss allegations, which, of course, do seem extraordinary, of eminent people sexually abusing children. And in this particular case, he was doing so even though he knew they were true because the guy himself had admitted it to him. Now, you know that the media can really only get its head around some simple personality stories. So since that evidence was so self-damning, if I can put it that way, and the Liberal Democrats moved quite quickly to begin disciplinary proceedings against him, and indeed I think they've suspended him pending the outcome of those disciplinary proceedings, it's become a personality story for the media to grapple with. And while they seem not to have been able to get to grips with the mountain of evidence that has surfaced in the course of the inquiry, notwithstanding the fact that plenty of stones have been left precisely where they were in the first place, they've sort of focused on Lord Steele in the way that the media does. It's a personality story. And he probably deserves the kicking he's been getting, but it's not all about Lord Steele. You know, he's just a typical example of one of those people who nonchalantly dismissed these kind of allegations made against MPs or other VIPs when they've got no basis for doing so. And in this particular case, as I say, he actually knew the allegations were true because the guy had admitted it to him.
We've also had Prince Charles involved as well. Apparently financial and property gifts to the Bishop Peter Ball, Bishop of Gloucester, who I believe is now being jailed. I mean, maybe out of jail by now. And also an association with his twin brother, Michael, who also was involved in ignoring abuse going on within the church down in Truro. So Prince Charles very close to these two, Peter Ball and Michael Ball, and giving gifts of property, that sort of thing. I mean, it couldn't get much closer to the establishment than Prince Charles, I suppose, could it, Mark?
Well, no. I mean, the issues surrounding Peter Ball didn't come up in the Westminster investigation. That was dealt with in a previous investigation, a set of hearings we'd had previously, which was investigation into, basically, under the umbrella of the Church of England, or the Anglican Church, as I think they framed it. It is yet another example of various establishment figures closing ranks, if you like, around Peter Ball as he was initially investigated, and that seemed to head off that initial police investigation. Nothing happened. I think he did get a caution at that point, and then they did return to it many years later, the police, and of course that resulted in a conviction. So, as I say, we actually heard about that in a separate investigation strand, but it repeats that pattern of prominent people dotted around the establishment who turn out to have been sexually abusing children, both boys and girls, or one or the other, and basically getting away with it.
There's also another MP called Peter Morrison, who was the personal private secretary to Margaret Thatcher, right, I think it was the last year when she was Prime Minister. Problems there. She apparently did not question the child abuse claims, and actually he was protected by both Thatcher, the Cabinet, or all three, Thatcher, the Cabinet, and MI5. So how did that all come out? That's more recently that one's come out, isn't it?
Well, first thing to say is that I think it's fair to say that in Sir Peter Morrison's case, the evidence that he was sexually abusing boys that surfaced in the course of his inquiry is not definitive. Nonetheless, there is evidence that suggests that he was doing that, and moreover, perhaps more importantly, from the point of view of how people in positions of power responded to those allegations, the fact that those allegations were live, as it were out there, was well known to the local party, to the national party, all the way up to the Prime Minister of the day, Margaret Thatcher, and for example, the Cabinet Secretary of the day, Robert Armstrong, Sir Robert Armstrong, he was then, he seems to have made a peer, and also MI5 seemed to know something about it as well. We had some degree of insight into MI5's what I've called the pedo files, literally the files they have on various prominent people that related to child sexual abuse allegations, which they did disclose to the inquiry. Of course, whether they disclosed everything they had is another matter. They certainly disclosed some material. And again, the material that they disclosed on Peter Morrison was less than definitive, must be said. I think what will become an issue for what the panel, inquiry panel, will have to wrestle with when they come to write the report, which they'll be doing over the course of the next few months, is deciding whether the failure to basically alert the police or to make sure the police knew, because part of the rumour was that the police were on to him, had even picked him up at some incident involving a 15-year-old lad in a loo in Crewe railway station. I think where the inquiry will probably go is, why did all these various people that got these reports not make sure the police were well aware of them and were investigating them appropriately? And, you know, the suggestion is that they weren't terribly keen to do that.
Finally, Mark, this is an enormous scandal, incredibly powerful people involved. You would have hoped or thought that it would be covered a little bit more comprehensively by the national press in London. It doesn't seem to have been. There's little bits and pieces here and there. What are your thoughts about the way that the press has been covering this inquiry?
Well, I mean, obviously, we have got the whole Brexit saga going on. The Brexit date was fixed for March the 29th, quite some time ago, and sometime before the hearing date was set, I think it was pretty predictable that whatever was going to be going on to do with Brexit, it was going to be dominating the headlines. Whether people might have predicted exactly where we are is another matter, but it was clearly going to be dominating the headlines in March of this year. So the Inquiry into Wisdom decided to put the Westminster hearings in March. I know some people think there might be a connection between those two things. I do not know whether there was, but certainly the coincidence is certainly there. And so that's part of an excuse, but it's only part of one. I'm sure the media can handle more than one story at a time, even though it often seems not to be able to. And what we've had is, I mean, I noticed in the early stages some ridiculously just inaccurate reporting surfacing in the media about what was going on with these hearings. And then, as you say, even though we've had some astonishing evidence, I mean, particularly from those police whistleblowers, I don't think any of it's been reported. I haven't even got on to, we haven't even discussed the witch notes from the Tory Dirt book, which were also quite interesting, and none of that's been reported. The only thing that has been reported really since the beginning, since the sort of, you know, we've got an inquiry starting, or hearing starting, which, you know, happened at the beginning of the month, was basically the day that David Steele metaphorically collapsed in the witness box. And that was even then, I think, was only when the Liberal Democrat Party decided they'd better have a disciplinary process. And just on that, I noticed that in the reporting, it's often said that David Steele said he assumed the allegations were true. Now, he did say that at one point, but it's really missing the point. Far more significant than just he made an assumption was the fact that he said Cyril Smith admitted it to him. So the reporting even of that, I think it shows that the media's just not able to grapple with something that's a little bit involved and requires listening to a few hours of testimony, and if they're not there, reading a few hours' worth of transcripts of the testimony. It's pretty poor, I would say, the coverage that there's been.
I said, finally, but look, you just mentioned there the whip's notes, the Tory Dirt book. Is that something that's already taken place, or is that still to come? Because that obviously is a very important part of all this.
Yeah, no, we've had that evidence. We had it from Michael Joplin, Lord Joplin now. He was Margaret Thatcher's chief whip here for four years or so at the beginning of her government. And it transpired that he had kept a copy of his whip's notes from when he was chief whip, as I say, often characterized as the Dirt Book. It's a series of literally notes. And the inquiry lawyers, we are told, went through his back catalogue, as it were, of witness notes from some 4 years, identifying those which were relevant, as it were, to the issues for this investigation. And, well, I think it's suffice to say that some of them were quite telling, really some quite telling glimpses of allegations and knowledge of what was going on in relation to certain Conservative MPs. I mean, including, for example, Sir Peter Morrison, who we mentioned before. I have to say, although I would reiterate, it wasn't definitive, it didn't prove definitively, in his case, for example, that he definitely was sexually abusing boys, but they certainly had material, which I think the Inquiry will end up saying they really ought to have made sure the police were aware of.
One of the shocking things that's come out about this, Mark, isn't it, that actually the whips may have seen these sorts of allegations and managing to crush them as a way to actually control Tory MPs, to keep them in line and to actually discipline them to vote when they were told to on a particular subject. That they saw that as an advantage. I think some people call it the black book, don't they? So every MP would have a page in the black book where the whips have, with a whole list of potential things they could use effectively to blackmail the MP to do as they're told.
Well, that notion, I suppose, in many ways sprang from the infamous interview given by Sir Tim Fortescue to a documentary many, many years ago. He was a whip in Ted Heath's days, and he basically, that what you just said there is in a way kind of what he was suggesting that they did. But it was a kind of very vague reference. He sort of referred to, you know, if an MP gets into trouble, it might be I mean, this is not an exact quote, but it might be a scandal involving small boys or little boys, I forget the phrase he used, then, you know, we'd help them out. And we'd also, because we'd help them out, would have them forevermore. Now, this essential point that Tim Fortescue was making in that interview was put to various whips or former whips who were called to give evidence, obviously, including Michael Joplin. We had Ken Clark, a former whip. We had Nick Brown from the Labour Party, chief whip. In fact, he's still chief whip now, I think. He's been chief, government chief whip over the years, and opposition chief whip. And basically all these whips said that they don't recognise what Tim Fortescue was saying. Well, make of that what you will.
Mark, how do listeners follow your work online? What's the best way?
Well, my Twitter handle is @MarkWatts_1. And what I've been doing at the end of each day of the hearings is going through the key points. So I've done a chain of tweets, day by day, a different number depending on what's come up during the course of the day, trying to highlight the key points from the day. And that's probably, unless you're going to pour through the transcripts yourself, which of course you can do because they're all available on the Inquiry website, that will give you quite a good overview of what's been happening over the last 3 weeks, which quite frankly, you won't get anywhere else.
And how long is the hearings going on for? I mean, so sometimes people take a very long time, don't they?
Last day, we had 3 weeks of hearings. Last day was today, and that meant we had closing submissions from some of the core participants, and basically the panelists sent off on their merry way to go and write the report. I mean, they've got other things to do as well on other investigations, but they will be preparing this report. It's obviously a delicate one they've got to write. It's a very sensitive one. I mean, indeed, the very pressure that the police whistleblowers are talking about, quite frankly, the inquiry has faced itself, and I wonder whether they'll acknowledge that fact. But they're clearly very delicate issues involved, and they want to write this report very, very carefully indeed. I'm sure they write all their reports very carefully indeed, but this one especially so. I think there'll be a limit as to how much they really want to upset the establishment, I would have thought.
Okay, investigative journalist Mark Watts, thanks very much for joining us. And Kevin Carhill's also here. I know you've worked with Mark in the past. What do you make of what you've heard, Kevin?
Well, I think Mark was addressing the issue of the way the media is covering this, which it isn't. There's an issue of resources. But the focus, as ever, is on, you know, high or big personalities. An immense amount of child abuse went on in children's homes. And some QC and the head of one of the child protection groups did a study. And they said, no evidence of anything. And it took me half an hour in the National Archives to find over 100 sealed files from dozens of children's homes. I mean, is the inquiry getting down to that level, Mark, at all?
I don't think so. Mark's not with us anymore anyway. What about Martin? What we get is an incredible picture of these three peers of the realm all sitting down and basically saying, well, actually, we can get a bit of an advantage if we help this guy get off. And even though he's a child abuser, we'll just turn a blind eye to it because we may be able to use it against him in the future.
Well, I think there's the general, you know, the establishment sticking together and covering their collective backsides. But I think my take on this would be to mention the King Cora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, where the evidence suggests that MI5 were using boys as honey traps to entrap various people. And evidence has come out in recent months that the boys that were abused at King Cora were then subsequently taken over to the mainland and were being used in other children's homes. So this suggests to me that the use of children's homes as honey traps for senior politicians has been an ongoing strategy in intelligence services.
Heyman
was not just a diplomat, he was deputy director of MI6.
It reminds me of the film Conspiracy of Silence, which was made for the Discovery Channel by Tim Tate, produced it, and that programme, Tim was paid his $500,000 for it, but it was never broadcast. That showed a place called Boys Town in America, in the United States, where children were being sexually abused, and then it was decided that they were appropriate, then they would be then bused to Washington.
Well, that's right. And I think it's that, you know, this kind of bad behaviour, shocking as it may seem, is probably, you know, not as uncommon as people think at all levels of society. But the really interesting thing to me is its use as a tool of political control. If you've got a large chunk of senior people in various organisations who are compromised in this way, then they're pretty much going to do whatever you tell them to do, aren't they? Because they don't want to end up in prison on the nonce wing. Do they?
No, Martin has mentioned King Cora. King Cora had a sub-branch, which I physically walked past many mornings, and the local people seemed to fully understand that vile things were happening there and would tell you, oh, don't walk that way, that's an evil spot. And the target seems to have been unionist politicians. Kinkora was well within, you know, the unionist.
This is for blackmail, basically.
So
the idea is that this politician can be, is effectively a puppet, because if they start to step out of line, you can threaten to take them out through the Daily Mail.
Yeah, the Daily Mail was where they launched it. Because, you don't have the blackmail power unless you can get the media to run it for you.
Yeah, and that means, of course, that if you do the right thing, say, for example, voting for the Iraq war, then your backside will be covered.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's also have a look at some of the other stories this week. We've seen also, Martin, another one you sent me, many reasons to believe Vasily Prosorov's testimony about Ukraine's role in downing MH17. Now, this is the a Russian whistleblower, apparently, who's been saying, well, actually, he's a Ukrainian whistleblower, he's gone to Russia to tell them all about how there was a role the Ukrainian government had in bringing down the Malaysian airliner in the east of Ukraine back in, I think it was 2014. Yeah, 2014.
Yeah, I mean, the Western media have predictably ignored completely this guy's press conference, but he looks, I mean, obviously you can't just presume that he's telling the truth. He could have been primed by Russian secret services to tell a series of lies, but you can bet your bottom dollar that if he was showing, if it was a Russian defector showing that the Russians had shot the plane down, we'd be hearing all about it. But in actual fact, he's a defector from the Ukrainian Secret Service, and he's saying, well, no, actually, it was the Ukrainians who did it, and he even names two intelligence officers that he thinks were involved in it. Now, you can make of that what you will. It's a testimony of one person, but again, extraordinary that the Western media has simply ignored this guy's press conference.
What do you make of that, the sort of geopolitics or that kind of thing, Kevin?
Being ex-military myself, it didn't look like a planned bringing down. It looked like somebody got it mixed up. There seems to be a lack of intent. You know, they thought it was either a Russian aircraft or a Ukrainian aircraft. And these sort of bad things happen when people are in civil war.
I can remember the chairman of the National Security Council of Ukraine, Andrei Perubi, he resigned, didn't he, about 3 or 4 weeks afterwards, and giving no reason why he'd resigned. So it looks maybe as if someone had told him to resign.
Can I make the point that on the back of the shooting down of this plane, all the economic sanctions on Russia were kicked in? And therefore, there was definitely a motive for the Ukrainian SBU to bring the plane down and blame it on the Russians. And they will not be working alone. They've been working with... It's quite clear that they've got very, very intense relationships with the CIA and MI6. And these people are very tricky. They've always been very tricky. The snipers in the Maidan Square at the beginning, there's been a court case in Kiev, and the two of the snipers testified from Georgia that they were the ones who carried out the assassinations of the police officers and the demonstrators, and they were working for Shakashvili, and that they were orchestrated by a US colonel. Now, that's a court case that's already been concluded.
We covered last week, was it, or the week before, the arrival of all these B-52s at Fairford Air Base in Gloucestershire, not very far from here. And this week, those same planes, it seems, have appeared in the news. Russia's Su-27 jets twice scrambled to intercept US B-52H bombers over the Baltic Sea, Martin.
Well, they're always going to come here to do something. Whenever they bring that big sort of kit to Fairford, it's usually because they're going to send it somewhere to do something, because they're not usually based there. So, you know, the Russians, talk about telegraphing a punch. It was all over the Gloucestershire news, wasn't it? I mean, locals were very well aware of what was going on. And there they are, you know, provoking the Russians. Can you imagine if they were to fly some of their big bombers straight at our coastline, what we would do?
What would we do? We send up aircraft.
Well, they've done the same, haven't they?
Also, UK, another one hardly covered in the UK press, is UK Special Forces injured in top secret Yemen campaign. That's this week in the Middle East Monitor website. At least 5 British Special Forces commandos were wounded in gun battles as part of a top secret UK military campaign in Yemen. The troops are said to be members of the Special Boat Service, Royal Navy's equivalent of the British Army's SAS, which recruits mainly from the Royal Marines, which our Mayor Marvin Rees very much wanted to join the Marines, didn't he? The SBS specialises in mounting clandestine operations against targets at sea, in rivers or harbours, against occupied coastlines, says the Armed Forces website. The men, who are understood to be recovering in the UK, were injured in a top-secret military campaign, according to the Mail on Sunday, treated for leg and arm wounds following battles in the Sadr area of northern Yemen, where up to 30 British troops are based.
Well, yeah, I mean, it wasn't just Middle East Monitor, it's the Sunday Mail, a paper of record. But, I mean, in other words, we can be pretty much certain that these people were there and that they were wounded. And therefore, we are at war with the people of Yemen. And, you know, that's what we do. We go around the world killing people.
Yeah. I was in the Yemen 40 years ago. We were still trying to... Yeah.
Well, what about... What do you... Yeah, but I mean, what's the objective of all of this? We're just backing the Saudis, are we? Is this their war or our war?
Well, by joining in, we're making it our war, but it is the Saudis' war, and we shouldn't be involved.
And some people, Martin, say actually the Saudis are just a front for NATO and the West.
What you've got is a bonded oligarchy, where they're all intermarried and they've got all sorts of business deals in common. You know, the Bin Laden family were intimate allies of the Bush family in the oil business. Everybody knows that, don't they? Except they do and they don't. There's a kind of cognitive dissonance about all of this. You know, the Saudi royal family send their kids to our private schools and are, you know, probably having sex with young boys in London as we speak.
Well, that's a silly allegation, isn't it?
No, it's not. I'm just saying that the Saudi princes are pretty famous for being drug takers, alcoholics and abusers of children. And that's not because and of course they have diplomatic protection and they're our allies, so they never get arrested.
I mean, another piece of news this week from Saudi Arabia is the passing of nuclear technology to the Saudis. Is that a wise thing? Because, you know, we're told that the Iranians shouldn't have nowhere near this, anywhere near this, Kevin.
Yeah, no, I mean, I wrote the story years ago. The tornadoes we were supplying to the Saudis, this is 20 years ago, were nuclear wired. Nuclear bombs, you can't just hang them in an aircraft. You have to have the right kind of trigger mechanisms and all the rest of it. And there was very strong proof that we were supplying the Saudis with aircraft that could fly nuclear weapons. So who was going to supply them with the nuclear weapons was the question.
Okay. Martin, any more thoughts on that? Because, I mean, the Israelis, I'm just trying to get a clip actually get ready for of Moshe Kalon, but I can't actually get the clip to play, who's the finance minister of Israel. I thought it'd be quite interesting to hear his take on what's going on in the Middle East. But maybe in the meantime, Kevin, you can give us your précis or take on hiding wealth. First of all, it doesn't seem to be that difficult if you're really amongst the multi-billionaires to make sure that you don't appear on the rich list, or at least you can disappear off down it somewhat. Is it fair to say that there is a kind of super rich who can always find ways of keeping out of the limelight?
No, absolutely. And
how do they do it? And how do you know
they
that?
Well, a lot of the very wealthy families that we looked at might have assets of whatever, a couple of hundred million. And there was one family in particular, the Guinnesses, and we put them in at about 750 million. Then I met somebody from the board of the trust, and the sum in the trust was 11 billion. You know, if you can keep your stuff offshore in offshore tax havens, nobody's ever going to find it. Unless, of course, in the United Kingdom, we change the land registry and force people to put their real names in the land registry and put the real owners who are hiding in our tax havens all over the place in the land registry. That would be a very important change to showing where the wealth really is.
What about Jacob Rothschild? I mean, this is what we were discussing last week, the whole idea that that this is an anti-Semitic trope. If you're looking at the figures, Jacob Rothschild's apparently about twice as wealthy as the Queen, but he's still only at something like 400 or whatever on the rich list.
Historically, the Rothschild Bank and banking structure, and that includes banks in France and lots of other places were immensely wealthy, and you couldn't pin it down because the wealth wasn't recorded in their books, say, in the United Kingdom. And the Rothschild Bank is a bank. You have criticisms of banks. You have criticisms of the Rothschild Bank. There should be no issue of anti-Semitism whatsoever. If they're a bank, there are certain standards they have to meet, and if they don't meet it, you criticise them. But the wealth would be many times. The Sunday Times has quite rigid rules. If you can't see it, you don't print it. And, of course, the bulk of real wealth is offshore. You can't see it. And most of the offshores it's in are ours. They belong to the Queen. She's the sovereign of lots of these...
So basically, it's quite possible for the Rothschilds to completely disappear down the rich list, maybe decide for themselves whereabouts they want to appear.
They keep the operational banks in, say, Britain and Monaco and France keep public records. So you'd always be able to look at NM Rothschild London and say they're worth X because they have accounts, but you will not be able to see the offshore wealth.
Time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Sorry about having problems with audio in the second hour. I have to sort that one out for next week. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. Thanks to Martin Summers and Kevin Carhill. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 8, the emerging view among European leaders is the UK is facing the very serious risk of leaving the EU without a deal. The Prime Minister has just 2 weeks to come up with alternative Brexit proposals after MPs overwhelmingly rejected her withdrawal agreement. But US National Security Advisor John Bolton is reassuring Britain about the future.
People who worry about the UK crashing out of the European Union, that's the phrase they use, they're going to crash right into the United States. We're standing here waiting to make a trade deal with the United Kingdom.
Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn says it's time now for a change of direction and potentially new leadership.
There has to be an alternative found. And if the Prime Minister can't accept that, then she must go, not at an indeterminate date in the future, but now, so that we can decide the future of this country through a general election.
Other options will be discussed in Parliament next week. A man's been jailed for violently shaking his four-month-old son to death in Partington in Greater Manchester. The 30-year-old's been given 13 years behind bars for manslaughter, plus another two for controlling behaviour towards the boy's mother. Mexico's foreign minister is rejecting a threat from the US president to close the southern border to trade from next week. Donald Trump insists he's not playing games and is demanding Mexico stops illegal immigrants travelling to the US. A woman who gambled away £100,000 donated to her seriously ill son has been given a suspended prison sentence. Stacey Worsley from Leeds started betting online with money raised to help treat her son.